You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Now count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4. I like sand. Sand is squishy.
Dory, you're not alone. Counting to 10 is not as easy as it sounds.
We spent, what, 2 hours? I think it was 2 hours counting from just 10 to 6 last week.
This week, part two of our top 10 of 2016 roundtable. The next picture show, Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky rejoin us to reveal the 5 best films of the year.
That and more.
Sand is squishy.
Yes, it is, Adam. Ahead on Film Spotting.
Happy New Year's weekend, everybody. Welcome to part two of our top 10 of 2016 roundtable. We welcome back to the show from part one, not looking a day older than the last time we saw them, Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky from the Next Picture Show podcast. Scott and Genevieve, thanks so much for sticking around.
Yeah, it's been a great week.
Glad to still be here.
Well, last podcast, we of course trimmed it down for the folks listening on radio. The last podcast was pretty epic. We will see if we get into the same territory lengthwise with part two here. We certainly have a lot to cover. We have a lot more great voicemails as well from some special guests. But before we share our top five films of the year and hear those guest picks, we reference Finding Dory at the top of this episode, a film about a character suffering from short-term memory loss. Like it or not, arbitrary or not, these top 10 lists might as well be etched in stone once we record this show. There's no going back. And yet there are, of course, 10, 15, 20 or more films we all really, really liked that didn't make the cut. So I'm going to throw out to the group here, and Genevieve, we'll start with you. What film from your list, not your top 10, but a little bit beyond it maybe, do you most hope isn't going to be forgotten by audiences of the future who only have your list to guide them?
Well, I hope that The Edge of 17, the baby feature from Kelly Freeman Craig, takes its rightful place among the pantheon of all-time great teen movies. It stars a great Hailee Steinfeld as sort of a black sheep teenager. And I believe, Scott, you compared it to like John Hughes, if he was doing everything right, you know?
Yeah.
And I co-sign that. It's just a really, really great teen movie with really great characters. And I absolutely love it. I wish I'd been able to find a place for it on my top 10.
Yeah, I co-sign that. It's in my top 15.
Mm. Yeah, me too. I think it's kind of, it's like almost Ghost World light. The way I put it. But again, that sounds insulting, and it's not. This is the movie, the type of movie that I wish John Hughes made back in the day.
Hmm. What is your film that you would like to make sure people don't forget?
I'm kind of tortured on this, and I get to, which is my way of introducing multiple titles, but but because I wanted to choose between Tower, which is a golden brick, so I'm not going to mention that, except I just did, and the Nice Guys, which is probably the most entertaining Hollywood got for me this year, Little Men, which is a film, another film I love from Ira Sachs, but maybe I'm going to mention something that nobody seems to have talked about, which is a movie called Peter and the Farm. It's a documentary about a organic farmer in Vermont. He lives by himself. This is a family farm. The farm is a part of him. He has a very tough personality. He has a lot of demons, a very troubled past. He's got a very like prickly personality. And it's just a fascinating portrait of somebody who you'd see at a farmer's market and kind of wonder about. And this is his world. And it's a beautiful world. And it's also a very dark and disturbing place. And I think it's one of those documentaries where you can about farming and about the earth, where it just you feel like the soil is on your fingers. The texture is so rich.
So Genevieve, you took my pick, the Edge of 17. Yeah, I was all set to, but that's fine. It gets even more love then. So I'll go in a different direction. And one of the other movies that made me laugh almost as hard as Popstar was Keanu from Key and Peele this year. If we were going to have best action scene in our rap party, which I think we mixed this year, but we did have it last year, I would put that opening John Woo-esque action scene in Key and Peele, which is also very funny because it's mostly involving a tiny cute kitten. Microbe and Gasoline is another film that flew under the radar this year from Michel Gondry and has just enough Michel Gondry. It's unfortunate that the people who've given up on him and have had too much of his whimsy haven't bothered to see this, because I think they would bring them back into the fold. So check out Microbe and Gasoline.
I remember us reviewing Keanu on the show. I could have sworn that was you anyway, and I don't remember us differing so much on that film, but that would actually be among my top five disappointments of the year.
Oh, I know. I remember you not appreciating it nearly as much as you should have, and I was quite enthusiastic. And sometimes when that happens, I just shrug my shoulders and move on.
That's all you can really do, Josh. For my pick, I'm going to go with a movie that I had not heard of at all until one day, a few weeks ago, a listener on Twitter said, "Have you seen the movie Little Sister, directed by Zach Clark? It would be a shoe-in for the Golden Brick." And at the time, I hadn't heard of it. I said, "I'm just not familiar with it." Later that day, you mentioned Richard Brody from The New Yorker having my back with Sully, liking it even more than me. It's his number three of the year. Later that day, his list was published, and Little Sister was his number one film of the year. And that was my cue that clearly I did need to see this film. It didn't hurt that it was available on Amazon and is only about 90 minutes long. And I love this movie. It's one that certainly could seem overly familiar because it's similar to the movie Ida and a few others, the Buñuel film Viridiana, where it's about a nun who is about to take her vows, a young nun. She's in her early 20s, it seems, and she lives in New York. Her family's back in North Carolina, and she is about to take those final vows to officially become a nun and gets called back home and has that road trip back home where she has to deal with some family conflicts. And it's a dark, twisted, but very human and very, very funny movie. It also stars Ally Sheedy as her mother, and her brother in that film is a character who comes home from the war in Iraq, and he is badly burned and basically so disfigured he doesn't want to go out in public, doesn't want to talk to anyone, doesn't even want to talk to her. And the way that she manages to get him to open up and re-engage with her is really wonderful, and there's nothing overly schmaltzy at all about this film. It really does keep its edge. I'd say right up until maybe the last 2 minutes of the film, it might want to reaffirm a little hope, a little bit more than the rest of the film does, but it's really wonderful. I hope more people see it. We're going to get back into our countdown now. We're going to share our top five films of the year, and we're going to start it all off with a voicemail.
Hello, Film Spotting. This is Jim Pellini from Bethpage, New York, calling in. Let you know my favorite film of 2016 is Jeremy Saulnier's Green Room. After the success of Blue Ruin, you know, Saulnier could have gone to do a superhero, blockbuster, prequel, sequel, but instead he decided to film another original script instead. And really with Green Room, he takes genre filmmaking to a whole nother level. Formal invention, plotting, and lots of genuine on-screen surprises. Patrick Stewart is terrific as the droll but really ruthless ringmaster of the whole group, and he gives just an epic performance here. That's my pick. Keep it up, fellas. Take care.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you especially for saying a whole nother. That was a nice shout-out to Josh. He very much appreciated that. We'll understand a little more here in a sec why I wanted to open with that voicemail. Jim, talking about Green Room, other than the fact that Green Room is a very worthy movie to come up in this conversation, but as I recap my 10 through 6 picks here the long way, I wanted to set up my theme for the year that did certainly emerge well before I actually started putting these picks together, but just as I was eyeballing the films that really stuck with me throughout the year. And I was Googling this last night, just what was so terrible about 2016. You can just put in anything, like worst year ever or list of events that made 2016 so terrible. And one of the first links I came upon was a Slate article by Rebecca Onion. And in it, she writes, terror attacks, Zika, Brexit, police shooting, Syria, Trump, record hot temperatures, the losses of Prince and David Bowie. This has been one unrelenting turn around the calendar. She wrote that in July. Okay. So we had a lot more horror left in this year. And in that article we'll link to in our show notes, she gets 10 historians together to weigh in on where 2016 ranks among the worst years in history. So it's an entertaining read. But that theme for me, the best way to set it up is to go back to Green Room. I feel like we're all Anton Yelchin and his bandmates in Green Room. Terrible, unusual things are happening. A person's dead. You're being held against your will in a room in the back of a crummy bar with a whole lot of scary people outside. Nobody seems to want to get the police involved, but the club owner, Patrick Stewart, is talking calmly to you. He's saying the right things, and you want to believe him, because if you don't believe him, this gig is going to be the last thing you ever do on this earth. I think that's us. We're in freakout mode for most of this year. We recognize something is definitely wrong. It's entered our minds that we could be in serious trouble, but we're still clinging to a sense of normalcy. We're holding out hope that somehow everything is going to be okay. And now as we sit here nearing the end of December, I feel like we've all just unlocked the door like Anton Yelchin does in Green Room at one point. Chaos has ensued. And not only are we battered and bloody, our arm is so hacked up, it's almost detached from our body, and we're in a total state of shock. So, you know, Merry Christmas, Bedford Falls. Happy New Year as well. That's it for me, though. The theme is trauma, individually, collectively. Most of the films that really hit me this year dealt with how characters processed and moved forward from tragedy or traumatic events in their past or their present. So just look at the movies that miss my top 10. Some of these have come up already in conversation or on your list, including Green Room, Manchester by the Sea, the film that could have replaced La La Land at number 9 on my list, The Witness, Hell or High Water, The Edge of 17, Camera Person, Certain Women, Sunset Song, Little Sister, Arrival, and then my pick so far, number 10, Sully's Landing on the Hudson. My number 8, Chet Baker hitting rock bottom because of heroin addiction, but also being badly beaten at the beginning of Born to Be Blue. My number 7, Krisha, addiction and family estrangement leaving its scars on those characters. And number 6, I'm not going to begin to unpack the degradation and horror witnessed by some of the characters in The Handmaiden, which also begins in Japanese-occupied Korea. Of course, in the mix there, my number 9, La La Land. The biggest horror in that film, I think, is Ryan Gosling having to play Flock of Seagulls on one of those keyboard guitars. It's bad, but
I would argue the piano solo in that John Lennon number is
hey, I think that's a pretty out there solo. No, I'm a fan. But look, it can't all be misery. So trauma runs through my picks, runs through my honorable mentions, and it's going to come up quite a bit here in my top 5. So I got that off my chest. I think we're ready maybe to move forward. Josh, recap your 10 through 6 and give us your number 5.
Okay, so at 10, I had Loving. At number 9, I had Tony Erdmann. Number 8 was Camera Person. Moonlight took my number 7 slot. And then at number 6, I had The Neon Demon. All right, Adam, I will see your trauma and raise you the unmitigated joy of La La Land.
Ah, heal me.
You need this on your list. I'm glad it's on your list, and it is here on mine at number 5. We gave it a full review in the show. You already mentioned it, Adam, in our last episode, so I'm not going to say much more about Damien Chazelle's original, we should emphasize, movie musical, which I do think balances the perfect amount of affection for the classics of the genre with the desire to take the form into an exciting new age. The movie is just pure joy. For me, it's been fun hearing others describe it that way as it's rolled out into more theaters. And they've had a chance to see it, especially now that it's getting to be in wider release. It's also nice to see that despite grumblings in some corners, it continues to collect serious critical respect. I saw on Letterboxd just yesterday, I think it was, Jonathan Rosenbaum gave it 4.5 out of 5 stars, called it manic depression at its finest. So I described La La Land as a... I've described it as a movie mood ring for its responsive lighting scheme and the way the colors will work in concert with the character's emotions. So the other day I looked up what mood ring colors mean because I had no idea. And I can say that if I was wearing one while watching La La Land, it would have glowed bright pink, which means very happy, warm, affectionate, loving, infatuated, curious. That's good enough to make my top 10 list. So I've got La La Land here at number 5.
Well, the best part of that was now I know what I'm getting you for Christmas.
I can't wait. It'll
I think
match
it would look great.
My sweater.
Well, we had it out a little bit about La La Land. Obviously, I'm with you overall. My number 9 film of the year, Tasha Robinson's number 1 film of the year. And I know we talked about, Josh, how badly we both wanted to see it again and see it on the big screen because neither of us had that experience. Now, have you been able to go to it again?
No, but we have family plans to do it, and I can't wait for that.
Yeah, my daughter Sophie, whose favorite movie is Singing in the Rain.
Oh, she's going to love it.
I can't wait to take her.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it twice. I did see it on the big screen first and then again at home. And I have to say, it is one of the, it's a film, while I'm in the moment, I'm just enthralled by it. And then it's just, it's almost just like sand through my fingers. I just cannot, I can't grasp it. It doesn't feel substantive to me in a way that I feel like it should, though I do appreciate the style of it. I think the one of the important things I would say about it is that audiences are finally going to get the sensation of seeing a true musical that's been written and choreographed for the screen. It's just so rare. I mean, you see a lot of what you see are, you know, Broadway to screen adaptations, and the staging on that and the blocking is just so leaden to me. And to see a film this fluid and graceful and, you know, where the camera is really involved and the moves are, the technique is really thought through. That's just very satisfying just as a film experience, whether or not, you know, it has, you know, the depth that you want from it or not.
Yeah, that's one of the things I want to look at on a revisit, because initially I thought it bursts out of the gate so strongly. I thought, whoa, is the camera going to be doing this the whole time? I love when cameras move, but I don't know if this was too much. And so especially in a big screen experience, I'm curious to see how that does strike me. But yeah, it's interesting because I can't say that La La Land means anything more perhaps than this very familiar and quite generic dreamers who dream story that it's giving us. But sometimes when the movie knows how to use all these other things it does, music, choreography, costuming, art direction, cinematography, when all that's clicking, sometimes it's enough.
Scott, go ahead then with your 10 through 6 recap and your number 5 pick.
Sure. My number 10 is Aquarius, the Brazilian film. 9 is Elle by Paul Verhoeven. 7 is Moonlight. And 6 is the Hong Sang-soo film Right Now, Wrong Then. And my number 5 film is Patterson by Jim Jarmusch. This movie is a gift. There is no movie in 2016 that made me think more about the way we live now and whether it makes any sense at all. Jim Jarmusch has been his stubborn, independent self from the beginning, and Patterson is like a justification of that simple, emotionally fulfilling, analog lifestyle. You know, everybody can have their superhero movies. This is my idea of fun escapism, just to live in this world that is such of a different tenor than what we're used to experiencing in 2016. And it's not one of those films that's snooty about it. It's not like, I don't have a TV, I don't watch TV, and I don't have a cell phone. And even though those are kind of aspects of the movie, it's just about people choosing to live their lives in a certain way. And there's an intimacy to this film and a humor and a lack of stakes, which you usually like. You're a great appreciator of stakes, Adam, but I think in this case, you know, the less, the more.
How was your day?
The usual.
Getting your writing done?
I did a little, yeah. Working on a poem for you.
A love poem?
Yeah, I guess if it's for you, it's a love poem. It's kind of inspired by our Ohio blue tip matches.
Really? Does it mention the little megaphone shape the letters make?
Yeah, actually it does.
How beautiful. I can't wait to read it when it's done. I also painted new shower curtains. You should see them.
I'm with you. I enjoy the film quite a bit as well. It had me at William Carlos Williams. Any movie that features his poetry prominently is probably going to work for me.
So much about that movie is the routine of their lives as well. And I think when that is done well, it does set you in that world perfectly so that when you know what to expect and you anticipate it with pleasure, there's no redundancy, even though this couple does follow the same pattern. It's more a pleasure you have of living in that pattern with them.
Yeah. And then you get the wonder of surprises, the breaks in those routines.
Which are so tiny, but reverberate all the
more. Yeah, I think it's a Saturday morning and all of a sudden they don't wake up in the same bed together. She's already out, and that shakes everything suddenly. Yeah.
And they spend the week getting the cupcakes ready, and the cupcakes have to go to market, and that's pretty much, you know, the emotional climax of the thing. But I also appreciate the fact that the poems are good.
They are.
In the film, because there's so many films where they were about artists or musicians or writers or something where they end up finally giving you what that art is, and it's awful. It's what I call Mr. Holland's opus syndrome.
You didn't like the opus?
No, the opus is just is so awful.
More like an
opus. Everything's great, but the opus. But I love Patterson, and it's a film that I really long to live in and to escape to as often as possible.
And it's got a great dog performance.
Oh, yeah.
Best dog performance
best of the year. Without a doubt. Best animal performance, I'd say, above Black Phillip.
Black Phillip might eat this dog.
What about Keanu?
Keanu kind of fades after that opening action scene.
And what about Pandora and Things to Come? It's been a great pet movie. It's been a great year for pets.
We need that top five.
Don't call Black Phillip a pet, please.
Nelly the English Bulldog or nothing.
To your point, though, I love the fact, too, that we see some evolution in his poetry. It isn't always just that first draft, but we see multiple drafts sometimes of the poem he's working on, and we actually do see it get better.
Well, and the ultimate fate of that poetry is interesting, and I won't spoil it, but it does end up kind of commenting on the value and nature of creation and of art.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, speaking of art, great art, and creating it, let's talk about some of the creators of your favorite films of the year. Recap your 10 through 6 and give us your 5.
Well, at number 10, the most artistic film of the year, pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping, the Lonely Island film. Number 9, I had 10, Cloverfield Lane. Number 8, I had American Honey. At 7, Loving. And The Fitz is my number 6. And leading into my number 5 film of the year is Ava DuVernay's 13th. No film has stuck with me more than this documentary, which I've thought about literally every day since I saw it, which is several months have gone by at this point since I saw it. The argument she's making with this film, which is that there's a direct social and cultural line to be drawn between the United States' history of slavery and its current state of mass incarceration of Black men, is both convincing and haunting to anyone who's engaged with the state of our society today, intellectually or emotionally. As a piece of documentary filmmaking, it's not especially groundbreaking or unusual, formally speaking, but it's very, very well wrought. DuVernay makes judicious and smart use of the standard documentary elements, your talking heads, your archival footage, on-screen text, and it just comes together in this extraordinarily confident and really heartbreaking argument about the state of race relations in our country.
History is not just stuff that happens by accident. We are the products of the history that our ancestors chose, if we're white. If we are Black, we are products of the history that our ancestors most likely did not choose. Yet here we all are together, the products of that set of choices, and we have to understand that in order to escape from it.
It's one I need to see still, and being a documentary and being readily available, I think Netflix.
It's a Netflix exclusive, so it's streaming. Yeah.
There you go. It's streaming there. So easy to see, and I am going to catch up with it soon.
Yeah, I wasn't able to get to it either. I really want to. It does remind me of, and I would also point listeners to, if they're interested in this topic, a 2012 documentary from Eugene Jarecki called The House I Live In. Mm-hmm. That was quite eye-opening as well and very investigative. It more explores incarceration specifically in light of U.S. drug policy, but speaks to many of the same issues. And yeah, those two side by side, I imagine, would be a really invigorating, challenging, disturbing watch.
Yeah, I was trying to put my finger on the name of that movie because I remember we were both big fans of that film.
Yeah, and I can second. I have seen 13th, so I can second Genevieve's recommendation. DuVernay just lays out an extremely persuasive and well-constructed historical argument. And she, as unfussy as the style of the film is, as familiar as the style of the film is, she does hit you with a couple of montage sequences late in the film that are just remarkable and kind of really drive the point home when it needs to happen.
That's so great to hear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're ready for my number five, and it is a film that has come up already, made Josh's list, made Scott's list, and was the number one film of the year, according to Alyssa Wilkinson from Vox.com, who called in during part one. We have another guest who is very high on this film as well.
Hi there. This is Mariah E. Gates, also known as Old Films Flicker, and my favorite film of the year was Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. I think it is the most empathetic, beautiful, feeling film of the year. It taps into a facet of American life that I think is not often given the light of day. I think that it is a wonderfully impressionistic, unique film. I think that Barry Jenkins has an amazing point of view, and I think it is filled with probably the greatest acting ensemble of the year. It's one of those films that makes you really understand the power of film. And I think if more people saw a film like this, they would open their hearts to so much more than what they allow themselves to feel. So if you get a chance, you should see Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, and it might just change you for the better.
Mariah Gates, the star of our recent episode where we reviewed The Edge of 17 and shared our top five teen girl movies directed by women. She was great on that episode if you haven't caught up with it yet. And in part one of this roundtable, I talked about the element of the miraculous in my choices and the standout moments that moved me. How about that last sentiment from Mariah, who couldn't stand to have their hearts opened a little more? How miraculous would that be, a movie actually changing you, a movie that has the power to transform you? I think Moonlight could be that movie, and I think that's why, regardless of where I rank it or any of us rank it in relation to the other movies on our individual lists, Moonlight for me is the movie of 2016. It's the only one, spoiler alert, that does appear on all four of our lists. There is a reason for that. And I want to echo what Mariah said about that acting ensemble. Mahershala Ali, Janelle Monáe, Ashton Sanders, who plays the middle incarnation of Chiron, the boy at the center of this story, Alex Hibbert, the young boy in the first part of the story. The trauma, of course, comes in their upbringing, being raised by their drug-addicted mother, who's played really finely by Naomi Harris. And then the two actors Moonlight closes with, Trevante Rhodes and Andre Holland. I really wish Moonlight didn't have to end. I just wish I could check in on those two from time to time whenever I could. And most of it takes place at a diner and them sitting across from each other. Whenever Kevin says something a little prodding, a little bit too personal, we get that puppy dog look on Trevante Rhodes' face. And you're watching this big, tough guy, someone who clearly has taken the approach to the world that he wants to have an intimidating persona. And he just seems to melt before our eyes. And when I think of Moonlight, the first thing I think of is that face and the complexity of the emotions on his face. Him grappling with those emotions in those moments. Rhodes finds a way to convey it. It's certainly one of the best performances of this year, and it makes me melt a little bit just thinking about it.
So, Chiron,
what you looking at me like that for?
What, man? Come on, you just drove down here?
Yeah.
Like you was just on one. And you hit the highway.
Yeah.
So where you gonna stay tonight, man?
What's nice about doing this top 10 list as a roundtable is it's always interesting to see what does bubble up as the common film. I don't know if we always have one that's on all four lists.
I think it's pretty rare. We have a lot of
times we have three. Right?
Yeah.
And if that shows Moonlight to be the film of 2016 because it has such a crossover, I'm fine with that. All right, as we get to my number four pick, we are getting into 4 out of 4 star territory here for me. And that's what I rated these final four films on my list, which is rare for me to have that many in one year.
But tough
that
critic.
Is, yeah, yeah. That's how entranced I was, though, by Thai director Pichapong Rasathakun's Cemetery of Splendor, this languid meditation that centers on a group of soldiers who are suffering from some mysterious sleeping sickness at this tiny rural hospital. So this is what I would call one of those body rhythm movies that I talk about on the show. I think Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is another one, as is the documentary Leviathan. You have to slow down your normal state of being and let the film sort of seep into you. And if you can do that with Cemetery of Splendor, the lighting in this film, the rhythm of the scenes and the compositions are just going to lull you into this spell where the same thing that's happening to the characters almost seems to happen to you. And that's this feeling that waking life, dreaming life, and then memory. This is so much about memories. All those things seem to merge into one state of existence. I would say this is really one of the rare metaphysical experiences I've had at the movies, and I would compare it to something like The Tree of Life, which maybe more people are familiar with and felt something similar. So, Scott, I know that you're a fan of Rasathakun's Uncle Bunmi, who can recall his past mm-hmm. lives. For me, that one was, as much as I appreciate it for many of these same elements, there was a lot about Thai folklore and other elements that I just couldn't access. And so it was more of an appreciative experience. Something about this, and maybe it's emphasis on character, I don't know. I felt more of being in the frame of the film itself.
I think you might. Is that the only other one of his you've seen?
Yeah, so these are the two of his I have.
Because, I saw the Cemetery of Splendor probably a year and a half ago, so my memory of it is not that strong. But, you know, Blissfully Yours, Tropical Malady, you know, Syndromes in a Century. These are all worth checking out. And I think you're right about, you know, maybe slowing your metabolism around a little bit. The one thing I really appreciate about his work, which wasn't quite as present in Cemetery of Splendor for me, is just there's an element of magic that kind of comes into play in strangeness and something arising out of the everyday that is totally unexpected and lyrical. So I would encourage just continuing to explore his filmography and also just to open yourself up to it. I mean, these are foreign films with an emphasis on foreign. You will not get everything that's going on in one of his films. But that's okay if you just let that go a little bit and just, you know, give yourself over to the experience. Then I think you really end up loving his films.
Yeah, and I think the magic, too, in Cemetery is, you're right, Uncle Bunmi, like, features literal ghosts in a sense, right?
Yeah.
But here, if you remember, there are those glowing lamps by each soldier's bed that change colors so imperceptibly. And there is a moment later in the film where we get a series of nighttime shots of the nearby town. And somehow the coloring of the whole screen begins to just ever so slightly change like those lamps do. And again, it's just that bleeding of what we were experiencing before, leaving one place, moving into another, and then flattening out the whole cinematic space. So,
yeah, I mean, he's somebody who really likes to combine, you know, certain experimental elements into narrative filmmaking to, I think, a really distinctive degree.
I'm going to admit, maybe a little bit shamefully, that I'm quite certain I could open myself up to this film the way you described, Scott, and I could get on that wavelength and be lulled into the spell of this movie. I just knew, frankly, that there was no way it was going to happen as I was cramming in movies here at the end of the year.
No, it is not one to
and
put
so
a
I
year-end
refrained.
Cram session.
No, so at some point when I'm in a better headspace, I will dive into Cemetery of Splendor. Scott, your number four.
My number four is The Handmaiden, which to me is hands down the most entertaining movie of the year. And certainly, is there a more technically dazzling film? No. There isn't.
No.
His movies, Park Chan-wook's, he makes movies that are calibrated like a Swiss watch, you know, with all of these ornate plots and camera moves and set pieces that are extraordinarily difficult to pull off, but made to seem so easy in his hands, and I was just gave myself over to this film. In fact, I've given myself over to it to such a degree that I have no intellectual justification for liking The Handmaiden as much as I do.
You don't need it.
I like to have, you know, I like to have to be able to say it has this theme or that theme, or it's exploring this or exploring. No, it just really is. I'm glad that you said it was about storytelling, because that's really something I can kind of grasp onto. It is about that. And yeah. It is about him being the maestro and pulling off all of these sleights of hand as an audience. And I was just delighted by it. You know, and I think it is also sensually pleasing.
Yes.
Can we say it? I mean, it's kind of a turn on to watch this film.
Mention eroticism.
Yeah, so I know. I mean, it's something that maybe critics are too embarrassed to say or to write about, but, you know, it's hot stuff.
There
film.
It is. Yeah, and you said, Scott, when I tweeted about it, because I just saw this a few weeks ago, and I watched it actually in Philadelphia at a Landmark that had about 15 people in it, and I became very aware of the much older couple behind me during one of those explicit erotic scenes, yeah. And I heard some interesting phrases coming out of their mouths, but I didn't see it with a crowd. They seemed into it, but it certainly wasn't a full crowd. It wasn't a raucous crowd. They weren't laughing at as many moments as I was. They didn't seem as caught up in it maybe as I was. You've seen it at the Music Box where the experience you described was everyone was on the same page.
It was wonderful because I saw it first in Toronto and then I saw it here. It's been having an incredible run at Music Box. It's been there for probably 2.5 months now. And I ended up seeing it on the smaller of the two screens, which is quite small, but it was packed. I mean, there was not an empty seat, and the level of engagement with that film was high.
Yeah, I also saw it at the Music Box in the big theater, so neener, neener. But I was just thinking, listening to you talking, so many of my favorite movies this year are tied in my mind to like really great theater experiences, and Handmaiden was definitely one of those for me. It was, like I said, in the big theater at Music Box. It wasn't full, but there were a lot of people there, and it wasn't necessarily even the most like vocal or expressive audience, but you could just feel in the air that like everyone was on the hook. Like everyone was being taken on this ride together and loving it. Yeah.
Now, Scott, apply that logic, the pleasure logic, to La La Land, and you'll be fine. You know, it's a little more chaste, I'll give you that. So.
That's the problem, I think.
I think we're finding out the real element that was missing from La La Land.
It's not hot
for
stuff.
Scott.
Yeah. It's not that.
Could use more hot stuff.
Yeah, more bells. More bells.
Well, we're not going to give up on The Handmaiden just yet. We have a Film Spotting listener who also has a lot of affection for this film.
Hey, Film Spotting. This is Randy Grimshaw calling from Stony Brook, New York. My favorite film of 2016 is Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden. Now, when I viewed this in November, I recall having very little knowledge about the narrative, and I think that was the best decision I made because this film surprised me at every turn. I thought it was stunning. It's a sexy spectacle with a beautiful cinematography, set design, costumes, the performances, the music. It's really something special. And in a year of some really strong films, I'd have to argue that The Handmaiden edges out La La Land to be my favorite film of 2016.
So Randy's got your back, Scott. Yep. Sexy.
Prefers I heard him say it. As well.
Yep.
Genevieve, we're ready for your number four film of the year.
My number four is Manchester by the Sea. I admit I was not expecting to love this movie as much as I did, perhaps because I know Scott Tobias really admires it, and I am always expecting to not like the things that you love. But more so, I assumed, based on what I knew about it, that it would just be this like dirge-like study of grief. It would just be this emotional slog. And while this is an exceptionally moving and at times emotionally difficult film, it is in no way hard to watch. It's really captivating, especially in its performances and cinematography. But most of all, there's a strain of humor percolating under the whole thing that just makes the emotions of this film feel so much truer and well-rounded than if it was just pummeling sadness.
Things are a little bit up in the air.
No, I can take care of it as far as the general maintenance is concerned, but that motor is going to go at some point.
I'm taking care of it. There's no allotment for a new motor. Unless, George, you know someone who wants to buy it.
Wait a second, I'm not selling it.
We're going to be in Boston anyway.
What? Since when are we supposed to be in Boston?
Just take it easy.
Well, whatever you decide, it's going to bleed you dry just sitting here.
We don't know exactly what we're doing.
Well, you know, he can always stay with us if he wants to come up weekends.
Do you want to be his guardian?
Well,
he doesn't want to be my guardian, for Christ's sake.
He's got four. We're trying to lose some kids at this point.
No,
yeah. I agree. You really need that humor and that really strong ear for regional dialogue to carry the film over, because otherwise it would just be too sad to get through. You can barely make it through as it is.
Yeah, actually, I'll say, and I don't know if he wants me to say it or not, but Sam, our producer, finally saw this movie and knew really nothing about it, certainly as much as I did, the basic story, if you will. There is a revelation of a backstory with Casey Affleck's character that I suppose we can say explains why he might be a little bit closed off from the world. And Sam told me that if he had known what was going to be revealed, he might not have been able to watch the film. Mm-hmm. But as it is, he's really glad that he did. I think he has it as his second favorite film of the year behind La La Land. My number four film of 2016, I suppose after all that trauma talk, I have to offer the exception that proves the rule. I'm going to take us back to 1980, when the most tragic thing that could happen before college classes started up for the year was the keg running out. Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, with two exclamation points. Don't forget those at the end of the title. This, like Moonlight, features another great ensemble, which we, of course, do expect from Richard Linklater. We have Tyler Hoechlin's alpha jock McReynolds, the philosophical stoner ramblings of Wyatt Russell's Willoughby, and especially the amiable awesomeness of Glenn Powell's Finnegan. I really just wish I could pay Glenn Powell enough money to come live in Chicago, pretend he was Finnegan forever, and be my best friend. I don't see why that's too much to ask.
Why is the 230 hitter always the most superstitious? Newsflash, it's not working. Get some new superstitions.
You got superstitions.
No, I have routines.
Big difference.
No, superstitions are a holdover from primitive humans finding simple reasons for things they don't understand. Oh, yeah. Verifiably a complete waste of mental capacity in this day and age. I'm just saying, in a deterministic event such as hitting a baseball, there actually is a strict relation between cause and effect. And superstition, it's bringing a probabilistic framework and projecting meaning onto a completely random sequence.
On a deeper level, because I think this film, Scott, is one that you can just purely enjoy. And I don't know that Linklater would argue he's necessarily trying to go for too much more than that. Something we talked about during our review, the way Linklater codifies the rituals and the codes of these people in this place and time, I think is fascinating. And the way they move between different worlds, they're trying to figure out where they belong, who they are, what they latch onto, and what they discard along the way. Certainly themes in keeping with Linklater's filmography. One great moment in the film, the getting high with Willoughby scene. You got to tune in, man. You got to tune in.
And don't be afraid to let the experience find you. It's like Carl Sagan says, man. Beauty of a living thing isn't about the atoms that go into it. It's how those atoms are put together.
It's one of those funny, mind-expanding conversations that we not only expect, but I think most of us really love every time we see a Linklater movie. And to offer a little bit of support here, Bilga Abiri from The Village Voice wrote, "There's no real room for story, but we're carried along by the energy of the conversations as they trend further toward the speculative, the unknowable. The experience of watching this film is one of reflective exuberance. It's a movie about people who arrive sure of themselves and depart in the quiet confidence that all they know is that they know nothing." And Justin Chang, Variety, says, "Few filmmakers have so fully embraced the bittersweet joy of living in the moment, one that's all the more glorious because it fades so soon." Everybody Wants Some is available on DVD and Netflix and iTunes for purchase, though curiously not rental. You can rent it on Amazon. One of the best experiences of the year for me in the theater was watching this film with a crowd and laughing every step of the way. And as I said, watching these characters just come to terms with who they think they are and who they want to be.
Yeah, and it's so rooted in their specific practices. It's like an anthropological comedy, right? The sports bro in his natural environment. And when you speak about the ensemble, you know, Blake Jenner in The Edge of 17 is so good too.
He is.
This might be another case of Linklater finding, you know, some real talents early in their career. All right, my number three pick is The Lobster. if there was a drier comedy this year than Tony Erdmann, it was probably The Lobster from Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. Everyone knows the setup by now. The best pitch of the movie year, right? Takes place at a hotel where single people are forced to find a companion in 45 days or be turned into the animal of their choosing. At least it's of their choosing, right? Colin Farrell, he's bitterly hilarious as this recently divorced architect who's stuck in this ridiculous predicament.
Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years. Are blue-blooded like aristocrats. And stay fertile all their lives. I also like the sea. Very much. I water ski and swim quite well since I was a teenager.
So it's a satire of our obsession with marriage and really strong that way. I love the first half of this movie, but it becomes something more in the second half, opens up a bit, brings in Rachel Weisz, and some have even described this turn as romantic, where the movie goes. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it's definitely, for me, disturbing in different ways and off-kilter ways right through to its final shot. One of the what do I do with this now? Final shots of the year. And I do love those. This is another case also for me of a filmmaker returning to form just a little bit. Nicholas Winding Refn, I mentioned with The Neon Demon, brought me back into the fold. I loved Lanthimos's Dogtooth, was intrigued but not in love with Alps, which we also reviewed on the show, Adam. But I think that The Lobster might be his best. So I'm all back.
Better than Dogtooth.
I really do. Yeah, I think it is. There's Man. A formal, and Dogtooth is very interesting formally, but a formal precision to The Lobster that is so in sync with the dry humor that I just couldn't get enough of.
I'd love to see it again. I remember really loving the first probably two-thirds of the film and feeling like at the point where they get outside that hotel and
that's
they get
the
outside that
point.
Structure,
yep.
That's where the movie, it didn't lose me because I still enjoy it and I still recommend the movie, but my enthusiasm did wane a little bit.
It gives you a whole nother category of issues to start processing. That's
true.
For sure.
I question your questioning of the formal precision of Dogtooth, which is
no. I'm not questioning. I mean, recognize that it was absolutely there. It's one of the things I loved about it, but it's almost more austere in The Lobster, I guess, in a way that every frame seems to be going for some sort of visual joke, which was in Dogtooth,
yeah.
Absolutely. But here, and it might just be the fact that it has this hotel.
It's funnier. It's a funnier
such
movie.
It's a funnier movie, and it has a hotel which lends itself to so much formalism.
Definitely way, way more accessible than Dogtooth or Alps.
That is true,
yeah,
but still
I would
pretty
say so.
Weird. those two movies, Everybody Wants Some and The Lobster, are the two that I regret not seeing a second time, but just mm-hmm. like this itch that I need to be scratched. And I feel, especially in the case of Everybody Wants Some, that a second viewing would just like catapult it onto the list, and I just never got a chance. But both worlds worth returning to.
Scott, we're ready for your number three.
My number three is Silence. I read Shusaku Endo's book 25 years ago when it was first announced that Martin Scorsese was making it into a movie, and I feel it was worth the wait. This strikes me as a continuation of Scorsese's other explicitly religious films, The Last Temptation of Christ and Kundun, and of his. It's also a continuation of his not explicitly religious films like Mean Streets, in which Harvey Keitel holds his hand above the candle flame to feel a certain amount of pain that he feels he deserves. What's fascinating to me about Silence is that it's not a simple affirmation of faith. It's about having faith tested as much as possible and not necessarily having it affirmed. You admire the hope of these Portuguese missionaries and Japanese Christians for holding on to their faith in the face of persecution, torture, and death. But you're also made acutely aware of God's silence and the fact that these ideas are being planted on perhaps infertile ground. It's Scorsese making an Ingmar Bergman film or a Robert Bresson film through Paramount Pictures, and I don't think we'll see anything of its kind again. I feel like he's the last filmmaker who could possibly make a movie like this through the studio system, and I look forward to returning to it because I think it's just a film that you really like to kind of wrestle with. It's a dense film. It's a troubling film. It's not a terribly commercial film, and that was how I felt about Last Temptation of Christ in Kundun as well.
Don't speak to me. You have no right to speak to me.
Oh, I do, because you were just like me. You see Jesus in Gethsemane and believe your trial is the same as his. Those five in the pit are suffering too, just like Jesus. But they don't have your pride. They would never compare themselves to Jesus. Do you have the right to make them suffer? I heard the cries of suffering in this same cell, and I acted.
You excuse yourself! You excuse yourself! That is the spirit of darkness!
And what would you do for them? Pray? And get what in return? Only more suffering. A suffering only you can end. Not God!
Away from me!
I pray too, Rodriguez. It doesn't help. Go on. Pray. But pray with your eyes open.
Yeah, having read the book too, Scott, I hope you'd agree, Scorsese gets the one part right that he needed to get right. Not just to be a faithful adaptation, but to be a film about the subject matter in the way that Endo's book was about this subject matter, and that is when the main priest that we're following is forced to choose whether he's going to step on this image of Christ. That's mm-hmm. kind of the action that the Japanese will force the Christians to make to indicate that they have now turned on their faith. And the way that scene is handled has – it's the ambiguity you're talking about and getting at the complexity and the layers going on here where it's not just about whether he does or not. Mm-hmm. There's so much more at play. I do wish silence had carried that over right up to the final moment. But I think in that particular moment, the most important one, it's a thing of beauty.
Mm. It is a powerful film. Genevieve, you're number three.
All right. I think I am going to drop the only certified blockbuster on this roundtable. I could be wrong, but I think my number three is Moana, Disney's Moana. This movie is just happiness incarnate for me. As a longtime Disney watcher, it was just extraordinarily satisfying to see such a well-realized version of the Disney formula. All the elements in Moana are familiar to some extent, but they're just perfectly calibrated here, from the story to the characters to the music to the visuals. I love the attention and thoughtfulness that's paid to the Pacific Island sort of cultural markers that this story sort of assembles into an indeterminate yet highly specific time and place. I think that is a really great approach to sort of the non-Western, non-white fairy tale that Disney has in the past struggled with, which, plug, you can hear us talk about on the Next Picture Show when we compare this movie with Mulan. But Moana is a much superior film to Mulan, I would say. And the character Moana, she's a great hero, female or otherwise. Dwayne Johnson is tremendously entertaining as Maui. Hey Hey the Chicken is my spirit animal. And probably, with apologies to La La Land, this is probably my favorite musical of the year.
Every turn I take, every trail I track, every path I make, every road leads back to the place I know, where I cannot go, where I long to be. See the line where the sky meets the sea, it calls me, and no one knows how far it goes.
Music's great. Yeah, it is absolutely great. And every number, you know, there are the Lin-Manuel Miranda ones, but also the crab, what's the shiny crab?
Jemaine Clement performing Shiny,
Well, Tamatoa hasn't always been this glam. I was a drab little crab once. Now I know I can be happy as a clam, because I'm beautiful, baby.
I'm not sure who wrote that. I'm not sure.
It's still Lin-Manuel.
Is it? Okay. Yeah.
You can hear a great demo version of him singing it with a Bowie accent, or with a Jemaine Clement as Bowie accent, on the expanded soundtrack.
Did your daddy say to listen to your heart? Be who you are on the inside. I need three words to tear his argument apart. Your daddy lied. I'd rather be shiny, like a treasure from a sunken pirate wreck.
Yeah, and it's a different style, yet still, you know, is just what the movie needs at that moment, mm-hmm. right? Moana's a ton of fun.
I love it. I really, and seeing, doing the Next Picture Show with Mulan really highlighted the difference, the little differences that make Moana such a better movie. And I really don't know. I've listened to the soundtrack with my kids are crazy about the movie, and I've seen it many times. And I've caught myself continuing to listen to the soundtrack after they have left the car and I've dropped them off at school. I think there's a sophistication to it and a build to it. There are these reprised versions mm-hmm. of the main song, How Far I'll Go. Very emotional film, and mm-hmm. Very satisfying as comedy. The comic notes are very subtle and well hit.
Except for one joke.
Yeah, I know, about
we
Twitter.
We all know the tweeting joke.
I know.
Just pretend it doesn't exist.
That's the one not timeless element of the movie. But I think the movie has been drastically underrated by our critical.
Not by me.
Our critical brother. I think you're ahead of the curve on that, Genevieve, because I think it's a movie to treasure.
I kindly ask Josh that you never again question Lin-Manuel's genius on our show. Of course he wrote that song. That's right.
Okay.
Question whether or not he could produce that tune that you enjoyed so much. My number three is a film that our friend Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU has at number one. Let's hear it.
Hi, guys. This is Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU calling in with my number one movie of the year. Might be a controversial pick for some. I'm going with O.J. Made in America, the 7-plus-hour film by Ezra Edelman about the trial of the century. And I have certainly heard and read complaints that this is not a movie. This is a TV show produced by ESPN, shown there in multiple parts. But it was also released in theaters first. It played at the Sundance Film Festival, and the director has said that he considered it a very long movie. And for me, it was the best cinematic experience I had this year. Insightful and fascinating, thought-provoking, shocking, unsettling, all of these things. And to me, when people say that this can't be a movie just because it's really long, I say, why not? Why not make long movies? Why not really push the boundaries in terms of comprehensiveness? I like when a movie does things like that. Breaking the rules is sometimes pretty exciting. And honestly, I don't really care what you call it. I just thought it was really fantastic. Thanks, guys, for another great year of podcasts, and best wishes for 2017.
So back to some good old-fashioned national trauma, the verdict that divided the country, O.J. Made in America. And to Matt's point, there's no controversy on my end. I mean, if you're looking for a technicality, I suppose, to disqualify it, either because you didn't see it or you want to make room for something else on your list, that's fine. But the Chicago Film Critics Group and every other critics group that I'm aware of and the Academy are all calling it a movie, and that's good enough for me. I'm the guy, of course, who the joke is here on the show that I don't like long movies. OJ was so compelling and all of the other adjectives that Matt used that I would have had no issue at all watching the entire film play out in the theater. I binge watched at least 60% of it anyway. And the miracles of this film, I think, Matt touched on it a little bit, that ESPN gave Ezra Edelman the freedom to make this documentary as long as he needed it to be. And that almost an 8-hour film about OJ, something I'll say I never would have thought the world needed, or at least that I needed, could be so engrossing. And it turns out the world did need it, because despite being fundamentally about OJ, the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman and the trial and Los Angeles, events that of course happened 20 plus years ago, it turned out to offer more perspective on what celebrity is in 2016, what race relations are in 2016, what the dynamic between police and minority populations are in 2016, and more beyond that. It's an invaluable document, I think, that unfortunately is timely and also seemingly timeless. It shines a light on struggles that are centuries old, and they're struggles that of course are still playing out today. In terms of the moments for me, there's plenty of new information revealed that is disturbing, including seeing the crime scene and just how brutal of an act it was. And there's other bits that are frustrating, and sometimes they're hilarious, almost always absurdly so. You just can't believe that happened or that person said that. But there are a couple of mind-blowing revelations that actually shift your perspective and offer real insight.
Right now, that OJ's sitting there in the passenger seat with a gun pointed at his own head.
Somebody turned the TV on and there he is. 14 units of the Orange County Sheriff's Department and Highway Patrol, following behind a good distance.
Hell of a God. This isn't real. This can't be real.
I remember watching all that unfold, and I thought it was a lot of insanity, but the thought that never, of course, entered my mind as I watched that as a 19 or 20-year-old in the middle of Iowa was what everybody in L.A. who was watching it unfold was thinking, which is they were waiting for O.J. to get shot by the police.
I've covered so many of these things. This was not usual police behavior. If O.J. Simpson were black, that wouldn't have happened. He'd be on the ground getting clubbed. But because he transcended race and color to this exalted status of celebrity, he got a motorcade.
And that really caught me off guard, realizing that based on the history of the police and African Americans in that community, that was the expectation and that was the suspense of that. And I, of course, was feeling none of that suspense. The other part is when we hear Harry Edwards, who's the professor and sociologist, repeat what OJ told him by way of an explanation for why he couldn't be more politically active fighting for civil rights and other black causes. He said, "I'm not black, I'm OJ." I think it's easy to scoff at that, someone seemingly so out of touch with his heritage and his identity. And I imagine it's even easier for a black person to do that who maybe has more respect for athletes like Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali, who were more politically active. But we have to also accept, I think, that part of that identity crisis is brought on by us, society's expectations, society's double standards, and society's hypocrisies. And the movie certainly delves into that without ever trying to exonerate OJ or ever holding him up as a victim. And that's a feat. And I give Ezra Edelman a ton of credit. Could just as easily be my number one film of the year. That's how much I loved O.J. Made in America.
I spent much of 2016 writing about O.J. Simpson because I recapped every episode of The American Crime Story and every episode of O.J. Made in America. And of course, O.J. Made in America is, you know, by far the richer work, even though they're both quite good. And it's those little details that he discovers that kind of blow you away. I mean, the last third of the film is really post-trial, and you just forget about all of the crazy things that happened to him in Florida and all these sort of seedy characters he was running around with. But one of the things that really stuck with me about the film are the verdicts, because, you know, everyone remembers where they were when the verdict was delivered for the criminal trial and how much drama there was there. But then you get to this last third when he's brought up on these other criminal charges that are really overcooked.
Yeah, they're a little ginned up.
They're very ginned up. And the judge is drinking from what appears to be a big gulp in the middle of delivering her verdict. And it's astonishing how far he's fallen in removed from the public eye. He is treated to a much different brand of justice, a much more familiar brand of justice, I think, to African Americans than what he
payback.
Yeah. Well, but also the prelude to the murder, even not just the trial, is really extraordinary just in terms of setting that context that you're talking about, that it devotes so much time to kind of going into the racial history of LA and the police and taking a lot of time and effort to set the stage. I loved O.J. Made in America. I ultimately could not bring myself to consider it as a film. That was just my kind of personal take on it because I did not experience it as a film, as a single piece. I experienced it as episodes over a series of days and weeks. So I think if you did experience it as a film in a single sitting or perhaps two back-to-back sittings, like, more power to you. Like Matt Singer said, it's great no matter what it is.
I would say, too, don't sleep on the American Crime Story version that you were talking about, Scott. Aired on FX, right? Mm-hmm. People versus O.J. Simpson. It really hits upon a lot of these similar notes. The fact, Genevieve, you're talking about the history leading up to the trial. The series starts with the Rodney King
incident.
So, you know, it's got some very interesting performances from people like David Schwimmer doing good work that you wouldn't expect, maybe. Courtney B. Vance as
John
Travolta's
Cochran.
Hair. And some pretty amazing hair as well. So, yeah, if this is something that, you know, you are still interested in and maybe saw the documentary version but not the dramatic version, they're really doing some of the same things in very different ways. It's the home stretch next. A quick break to recharge with some holiday treats. I'm not taking these cookies back home with me, guys. And then we'll share our picks for the top two films of the year.
And continuing our annual tradition, as we did in part one of this special end of the year roundtable, we asked friend of the show, Sam Smith, to pick a couple of his favorite pieces of 2016 film music. He's a great musician and great designer, and he hosts a podcast called The Poster Boys, which you might guess is devoted to talk about movie poster art, and they interview poster artists. He also does a radio show in Nashville called OSTFM, where he talks about movie soundtracks. So who better here to make our musical selections this week? Last week, we played something from Johan Johansson's Arrival score. Sam also shortlisted Leslie Barber's score for Manchester by the Sea, Cliff Martinez's for Neon Demon, but here's something from his number two score of the year, Nicholas Britell's Moonlight, The Middle of the World.
Hey guys, it's Odie Henderson from RogerEbert.com. Thanks for having me on the show to talk about my number one movie of the year. It was a bit of a toss-up this year between three movies, between Ken Loach's I, Daniel Blake, a great social drama, and Patterson, Jim Jarmusch's love letter to my home state of New Jersey, and Fences, the Denzel Washington adaptation of the August Wilson play that won the Pulitzer back in 1987. And at the end of the day, I decided to choose Fences. It's kind of hard to argue with the great acting by Washington and Viola Davis and the rest of the cast and the great play by August Wilson, who adapted his own screenplay before he passed away. I mean, it took 30 years to get this to the screen, and what's on the screen is pretty much well worth the wait. And as far as La La Land goes, which seems to be the movie that everybody loves, I couldn't stand it. It's number 5 on my 10 worst list, which should get me in a lot of trouble, but I don't care. Anyway, Fences is my number 1, so hopefully I have some company in that regard, and you guys have fun.
Finally, our top two films of the year are just ahead. You heard Odie Henderson there, one of our great guests from earlier in the year, came on to talk about Southside with you, talk about films I think are underrated from the year, the Barack Obama, Michelle Obama first date movie. He's also a big fan of that film, but Fences, his number one, a movie that we all know we need to see, and Odie makes us want to see it a little bit more. I love that he was not asked to submit any comments about La La Land, but he could not hold himself back.
Yeah, wow.
He had to get the hate in.
Is it off your list now, Adam? Have you changed things?
I am easily persuaded, but I'm going to keep it at number 9. Sorry about that, Odie. Thank you for the voicemail. Let's get to part of Massacre Theater anyway here, Josh.
This is the part of the show where we typically do some Massacre Theater, performing a scene and giving you a chance to win a prize. We're going to spare Genevieve that particular form of embarrassment.
Scott has been forced through this before.
Yes, we're sparing Scott as well, I know. So he's not going to put up too much of a fight about this. We do want to award a winner for our last installment. However, a couple weeks back, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Hey, Davis, how you doing? Oh, pretty good, Captain. I just dropped by to thank you for saving my life.
Well, it was a life worth saving, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. And I want you to know something, Davis. Anytime I can do anything for you, anytime, any place, you just pick up a phone, huh?
Thank you, sir.
So long, Davis.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right, Captain.
I'll see you.
Captain?
Huh?
You could do one little tiny favor for me.
What's that?
Well, sir, I've kind of written a little song, you see, and I thought perhaps when we got back to the States, when this is all over, you know, I thought maybe if you put this song in your act, it might be a big hit for you.
Well, sure. Just pick up the phone.
Yeah. Captain, I just happen to have it with me right here.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, this is for two people. It's a duet.
Yeah, it needs two people, two dynamite entertainers.
But I work alone. I do a single. Who do you figure on for the other hunk of dynamite?
Well, I happen to know a fellow, Captain. He's pretty funny in living rooms, kind of has a fair voice, you know, and I... how about me?
Danny Kaye is Phil Davis, and Bing Crosby, of course, you recognize as Bob Wallace in 1954's White Christmas, written by Norman Krasna, Norman Panama, and Melvin Frank, directed by, and I'd completely forgotten this last time when we did this scene, Adam, Michael Curtiz.
Yeah, so funny, embarrassing story. I taught a class, my first class ever at the University of Chicago's Graham School. I taught a film class on Howard Hawks and Michael Curtiz, Hawks versus Curtiz, the auteur and the so-called hack. And despite teaching that class, I've never seen White Christmas. And part of the reason was it was on the syllabus. I put it on the syllabus because, kind of like with our marathons, I like to teach movies that I haven't actually seen. It will force me to watch them and discover something new. I'm learning along with the class. And as we were getting through the films and I was comparing musicals, Howard Hawks, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and White Christmas, I had some students in the class who were ranging in age from 50 up to about 75, and they were all like, why are we watching White Christmas? We could be watching Yankee Doodle Dandy instead. And I ultimately had to say, you know what? You're right. We're going to watch Jimmy Cagney in Yankee Doodle Dandy instead, and White Christmas was gone.
You know what? They were right.
Yeah.
Right?
They have
I
to
mean,
be.
It's sad.
It's Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, well, it's also White Christmas. Well, that massacre was part of a show that included our positive review of Damien Chazelle's La La Land, and we did the top five musical numbers with special guests Michael Phillips and Desiree Garcia. Desiree, one of the stars of Chazelle's debut film, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench.
Of course, also a professor of English and film who certainly knows her musicals. She was fantastic on the show. I did say, I think, I don't listen to the show. You know, I find it vulgar, so I don't remember what I said. But I said something along the lines of we were going to get really few entries for White Christmas.
I thought so, too.
I underestimated our audience, and we had a little bet behind the scenes. I told Sam we'd get this really low number. He doubled it. Well, guess what? We beat that by about five times. So apparently, our audience is very familiar. They were subjected to a lot of White Christmas around the holidays. Robert P. Bond writes, the fact you two couldn't pick out that scene tells me that your Grinch hearts didn't watch nearly enough White Christmas as children. Of course, I could just know it because it has been a family favorite as long as I can remember, and I have several friends who will break into sisters at the slightest provocation.
Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters.
Of course, the tie-ins are the holiday season and the musical connection. I just hope La La Land doesn't have any clunkers like White Christmas's mockery of modern dance choreography, a.k.a. the dedicated bathroom break number. As Robert mentioned, the White Christmas La La Land tie-ins are pretty obvious, but the listeners, they always surprise us, Josh. They always come up with more.
Here's one from Bev, who works in Chicago but lives in Northbrook. When broadcast television was the only game in town, White Christmas showed up every year and became a must-see for me and my siblings. We especially love Danny Kaye because he reminded us of our dad. The tie-ins with La La Land and the top five musical scenes are, it's a musical that is at its heart a love story, just like La La Land. Irving Berlin wrote White Christmas, and he also wrote Cheek to Cheek, which was cited by Josh as his favorite musical scene. The great character actress Mary Wicks appeared as Emma in White Christmas, and she played Mrs. Squires in Music Man, which was mentioned by Desiree. And here's my favorite tie-in. George Chakiris, mentioned by Adam for West Side Story and by Michael for Young Girls of Rochefort, appeared as one of the backup dancers in Rosemary Clooney's solo song, Love You Didn't Do Right By Me. He was really young, but unmistakable.
Okay, so the next show we do about movie musicals, Bev, who lives in Northbrook, is going to be our guest expert.
Sounds like she knows her stuff.
Chris Whiteford in St. Charles, Illinois, says, yes, both La La Land and White Christmas are musicals, but they're also musicals that feature performers aspiring to reach the next rung of the ladder that is their career. Additionally, White Christmas features one of my favorite songs from any musical, Count Your Blessings, which Bing Crosby's Bob sings to Rosemary Clooney's Betty. It's a song about counting all of the good things in one's life instead of sheep to ease Betty to sleep. Of course, La La Land often refers to a dreamlike state of sleeping. So even the title there is being brought into the connections here. It seems like I only started listening to your show 3 months ago, Chris writes, but as I counted my blessings up, I realize it's been nearly 3 years. Thanks for the fantastic content each and every week. Thank you, Chris, for that. There was a lot of love in the mailbag, Josh, for your spot-on Bing, though Aaron Kirk in Round Rock, Texas says, I do feel the world missed out on Josh not taking a stab at going full Bing. Rectify this soon.
Full Bing?
Full Bing. I think it's time for the first Film Spotting musical. We're just going to have to go a full episode, and you can do your Bing Crosby.
I'm sorry, Aaron. That was full Bing. That's all I got.
That's it? Maximum Bing.
Maximum Bing.
In Massacre Theater. We'll end with one last tie-in from James in Regina, Saskatchewan. Josh, don't call it Regina.
No, I never do. Not. I never do. White Christmas is all building towards the big show performed live and broadcast nationwide. Film Spotting itself is gearing up for its own spectacular The Live Rap Party, which I look forward to hearing whenever it's broadcast.
Okay, so James in Regina is actually my alter ego, and I just wanted a clever way to plug our live show, our year-end rap party, Friday, January 13. It's coming up, and it's at the University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts, a great, great venue. Tickets and information at filmspotting.net.
We're talking about not having an intermission, but are we going to have a dedicated bathroom break number? We might have to work.
We
might have to work that in now.
Fair enough. I'll also throw out there, because I know we have a lot of listeners in Los Angeles. You might be shocked to learn, Josh, actually not at all, that of all the cities around the world, even more than Chicago, we have the most downloads from Hollywood.
How about that?
From LA. And I'm going to be out there at the end of January. So we might just have a little Film Spotting meetup. You can keep an eye out on the site and on social media, and we'll see if we can get another mention in on the show as well. Finally, let's reach in to the kind of brimming, surprisingly, Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Familiar name here, Aaron Neuwirth from Laguna Hills, California.
I'm glad you said that because it was familiar to me too, so I Googled it. I was shocked that Aaron has never won Massacre Theater because I've seen that name a ton. I checked it out and it doesn't seem like he has won in the past, but he has entered Massacre Theater something like 150 times.
Wow.
And he just finally won.
White Christmas did the trick.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year, Aaron. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Hi, Adam and Josh. Melissa Tamaga here from Seattle Screen Scene with a film of 2016 that I loved the most. Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. It's a film that I found really hard to describe, maybe because it affected me so powerfully. And in its wake, I was left feeling sort of emptied out and exhilarated at the same time. Reichardt's film, a story about three women connected only tangentially to one another, builds what it is almost by negatives. The women are not really connected to one another by plot, but because of the juxtaposition of their lives in the space of the film, we're invited to consider other more tenuous but emotionally resonant connections. For example, there's a loneliness and isolation in the center of each of the characters' lives, and we see each of the characters' experiences of loneliness as very different, and yet the loneliness of each is made all the more pungent by the fact that the three women are in the same film space, this gorgeous, icy Montana landscape, and yet are personally worlds apart. So Reichardt built this interior, emotional, psychological space that is mirrored and magnified both by the characters' very specific, disparate lives and by the mise-en-scene. It's a kind of juxtaposition of character and landscape that Reichardt has always done so magnificently. She did it in Wendy and Lucy, in Meek's Cutoff, in Night Moves, and she does it here. And that's what makes it my favorite film of 2016. Thanks, guys.
Melissa, a guest co-host on Film Spotting earlier in the year, Josh, during one of your absences, we talked about the movie Swiss Army Man, did a top five as well, and great to hear some more love for Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. Let's get into those final two picks. Josh, what is your number two?
The Fitz, way up here at number two. Genevieve, so glad to see that it was on your list. It's a wonderful little debut film from first-time feature director Anna Rose Holmer. And again, as Genevieve mentioned on the previous episode, it follows an 11-year-old tomboy played by Royalty Hightower. She joins an all-girl competitive dance squad, and then shortly thereafter, some of the older girls begin to suffer unexplained seizures. So yes, some people have complained that, well, it's an obvious menstruation metaphor and not much else, but I think this is, you know, it could be that. There's definitely indications. You could read it that way, but it's so much more mysterious at the same time. It somehow managed to work simply and just open up so many more possibilities, especially in this really bold finale that I won't give away, but it does combine magical realism, which is maybe hinted at very slightly previously in the film and goes full blown here. It combines that with Pentecostal fervor, with choreography that's reminiscent of Beyoncé's Lemonade, which is another striking display of feminine identity from 2016. One of the scenes vying for my musical moment of the year, as a matter of fact, which we'll do at the rap party, comes from this finale. And that's something, you know, considering how many musicals we had, movie musicals this year. So I have a handful of titles on my top 10 list that exhibit filmmakers who are established and in full control of their particular style and powers and really hitting their stride. The Fitz, I think, probably offered me the year's freshest vision. So I really can't wait for more from Anna Rose Holmer.
Yeah, the Film Spotting Golden Brick Award was really created to highlight films like this that were under the radar and also to shine a light on emerging, really talented filmmakers like Holmer. And I think I can say, without giving too much away, while The Fitz is not a lock necessarily at this point to win the Film Spotting Golden Brick for 2016, there's still votes that remain to be counted. The Fitz is in the lead in the listener's choice poll at filmspotting.net, and you can participate in that if you so choose. We will announce the winner of the Golden Brick at the 2016 Wrap Party on January 13th, but definitely can't wait to see what's next from Anna Rose Holmer. Scott, you're number two.
My number two is Tony Erdmann. I've been following Marinade's career since A Forest for the Trees and everyone else, and her audacity continues to astound me with each new movie. Ade loves to throw viewers into uncomfortable situations, and Tony Erdmann follows that impulse to epic length in these awkward scenes of a father with these fake teeth trying to cheer up his daughter. She's mired in this miserable corporate job. It's worth the long, nearly three-hour journey to get to two of the best scenes of the year. Oh, virtually back-to-back. Are they not back-to-back?
Yeah,
back
they are. Yeah, pretty much. So.
Including the one and only time a certain Whitney Houston song has meant really much of anything to me at all. It's just, it's a surprising film. You don't expect a film that you would think to be of a small scale, you know, relationship between a father and daughter. Maybe that plays out in 90 minutes rather than twice that length. Mm-hmm. But these scenes are, you know, extended and full of little mini surprises within the scenes. And it really packs everything towards that back, you know, half hour or so that just knocks you out by how crazy it gets.
Yeah, it is such a fun kind of discomfort. You almost watch about 10 scenes of this movie, at least, through your hands as you're covering your eyes, because you just can't believe it. It keeps going, and it takes it to that next level.
Well, it's funny that Scott mentions there at the end and back-to-back, because you had said to me,
I was going to bring that up.
You were into the movie, and, you know, we're packing so much in these last few days, and you had watched, it's long, as you mentioned, Scott, the majority of it, and you said, is anything going to happen in the last 40 minutes
that's going to really vault this
to another level for me? And I said, yes.
Yeah, more often than not.
You're just about ready to get
that
there.
That might not be the case, but with this film, I did watch about the first hour, and then the next night I had to watch another hour, and I was into the movie, but there was about 40 minutes left.
Yeah,
and so I texted you, and I was just like, this is really good, but is it going to go to that next level everybody's talking about? And you're like, just keep watching. You're almost there. And it does.
And I think I should also mention, in terms of the composition of my list, the year was really defined by two things. One, the strongest can in years, with The Handmaiden and Patterson and Aquarius and Elle and Tony Erdmann, which many people thought was going to win the Palme d'Or. I think it went to a much inferior Ken Loach movie. But so it was that, and then a lot of the big prestige films of the fall, which are often disappointing. They all just delivered. And so that kind of made the list. You know, so it was a, kind of a sluggish first half of the year, and then it really kind of came on strong in the fall.
Genevieve, you're number two.
Well, I'm the last to the party, but at number two, I have Moonlight. I feel like there's probably not that much left to say about this movie at this point, which we have all showered with praise and affection, as have lots of callers. So I won't dwell on it too much other than to just reinforce the greatness of this film, which is just a beautifully specific and succinct story of kind of tortured self-discovery. And the immediacy I talked about in the last episode, it just forces that empathy that everyone keeps talking about for all of its characters, not just Chiron. So Moonlight deserves everything, all the praise that's been heaped upon it.
My number two film of the year is a movie that many Film Spotting listeners are just as excited about as me. Let's hear from one of them now.
Hey, Adam and Josh, Billy Ray Bruton here calling in from the great state of Alabama. And when thinking about my favorite film of 2016, there really was only one choice. It was my favorite film when I saw it back in March, and it stayed at the top of my list ever since. Lots of films have fought hard, Moonlight, A Monster Calls, Manchester by the Sea, but none have been able to dethrone it. It's not the best acted film of the year. It's not the best directed film of the year. It's not the best edited, shot, or designed film of the year. But no film has captured my emotions, has spun them around, and left me grinning from ear to ear quite like John Carney's Sing Street. It really is the most joyous, uplifting, and satisfying movie experience of my year. Not a single person I know who has seen the film has had anything but infinite love for it. And I'm afraid it's not going to get the kind of attention it should this award season, except for maybe Best Song, but I hope it still manages to find its way towards the top of Adam's end of the year list. We're living in pretty difficult and uncertain times right now, and there are certainly many chances cinematically for us to fester in that darkness. So it's nice to have a film so bright and colorful and full of love and affection. It is most certainly my favorite film of the year, and thanks to you guys for helping to change.
Well, you heard Billy Ray talking about grinning from ear to ear and joyous, uplifting, satisfying movie experience, and nobody who sees it that he talks to has anything but love for it. That's my experience as well. I've recommended it to at least 10 non-film spotting listeners, some who are really into movies, others who are just looking for something to watch with their significant other or on a flight. Every single one of them has come back to me raving about the film. And that's not counting, of course, all of the listeners via email and Twitter who have thanked me for the recommendation since I did recommend it. It was my number one film of 2016 so far back in July. And going to what Billy Ray was saying about these dark times we're in and this movie maybe being a little bit of an antidote for that, you could almost call it another exception that proves my rule to my trauma theme for 2016, Like Everybody Wants Some, except the plot description is notable. A boy growing up in Dublin during the 1980s escapes his strained family life by starting a band to impress the mysterious girl he likes. That is how the movie opens, of course. Young Connor, sitting in his bedroom with his guitar, hearing the commotion of his parents yelling outside his door, yelling at each other, and he's trying to transform that pain into a song.
Didn't share a mortgage, I would leave you.
Go on and leave anytime you like.
Go on then, you stupid bitch.
You stupid bitch.
The miracle of this film, just how perfect the original music is, and also how it becomes a story of not only a blossoming musician, but a blossoming filmmaker because of the music video component. This is the early 1980s. They're watching MTV. They're watching Rio by Duran Duran on TV. And Connor decides that that's another way to express himself and to try to get his music out there. More importantly, to try to impress the girl by casting her in his videos. I'll mention another listener, Frank Reichert in Martinez, California, just wrote in and said, a big thank you to Adam for the Sing Street rec. I showed it to my high school film class as a motivational tool as they worked on making their own music videos. It was a big success. Other moments from this film I love. The Drive It Like You Stole It video shoot in the school gym, that whole fantasy sequence that plays out there, and the practice scene. The song is Up. Billy Ray may be being a little too harsh on John Carney when he talks about how it's not the best this or the best that. Okay, maybe it's not, but there's still a lot of great technique here cinematically. The way we watch this scene start between just Connor and the other musician in the band, the guitar player and piano player, and it starts on them, long take. They start playing the song. It's nighttime, and then night turns into morning, turns into day. The camera swirling around the room. It basically compresses a few weeks' worth of practice, it could be, into one long sequence that's just a few minutes with that camera swirling around and adding more members to the band. I love those kind of touches. It's such a beautiful feeling. So add yourself to the list of people who is won over by the wonder of Sing Street. It's on DVD, it's on iTunes, and it's streaming on Netflix. And Joe, our producer, is in the other room, and this is where he's going to cut Scott Tobias's mic. He's just going to cut it because there's something wrong with you, Scott, is basically what I want to say. I know that you have your doubts about the beauty of this film.
I do. I think it's okay.
That's worst, not acceptable.
The worst thing you could have said.
That's not acceptable.
Sorry. I feel like I understand what John Carney is doing after three movies. They're all pretty much about the same thing, about people creating music together. There's a thinness to this film that kind of bothered me.
Some traditions have to end. Sorry, Scott.
This sounds worse than fine.
I compare it. I mean, just think about like other comparables, like We Are the Best, for example.
Yeah, this is a better film.
No,
that's fine.
Not a better film than We Are
and
the
I
Best.
Like We Are the Best.
Or Velvet Goldmine, which is so much a...
This is
so
a better
much,
film. No, and I like Velvet Goldmine.
I'll have to concede. I mean, I'm being told that the entire universe loves this film, and so I'm just going to go ahead and let that
just
let that
nod,
be.
Don't
be worn down, Scott. Stick to your guns.
I will nod politely and say that I'm glad that everyone enjoys this film.
This is where I would really, you know, every bone in my body is screaming to come to your help here, Scott. But I did enjoy Sing Street quite a bit.
Genevieve?
I knew I could not come on this show without seeing Sing Street. And so I watched it very recently and was indeed won over by it. So
is it fine?
I'll take it.
Is it fine?
It is fine plus.
Oh, okay.
Fine plus.
But, it's pretty good.
But not good enough.
No. It's in my top 15. But to your point, Scott, about mm-hmm. Carney kind of like doing the same thing mm-hmm. with the music, I think Adam pointed out the addition of the music video element mm-hmm. here adds a interesting new layer to that I would think as a film lover you would appreciate.
I did like that, but I didn't like
the videos
the
are inventive.
The ending's really bad.
Ending is what kept it from being like pure love for me.
His films, they're like this like a big fluffy dog. I gotta look in your face a little bit too much.
I love big fluffy dogs.
I do too, but like it's a little much.
I didn't know I did.
They're much. Fine.
But I think the ending has more nuance to it than you're giving it credit okay. for, but we will have to talk about that off air.
You know, the one thing that elevated Sing Street for me was a particular number, and you mentioned it. The Drive It Like You Mean It. Mm-hmm.
Drive It Like You Stole It.
Drive It Like You Stole It. Okay.
It's stuck in my head for a week now.
Well, I will say some of the songs they verge on the line of bad stuck in your head, and that one kind of does. But that number, what that number does, which does elevate the film and puts it in La La Land category for me, is because it does enter into that fantasy world. Mm-hmm. If I'm correct, it's the only one where it re-envisions what's happening visually in their heads.
It's
it got to me when his parents come in. It turns into this 50s prom, right. essentially, and his estranged parents come in as a happy couple. I mean, that was, I let the dog, you know, jump up on my lap.
I guess that's, I guess that's
gave
all,
it a little you pat on the head.
All
point,
that,
but.
All that inventiveness and creativity is just fine, I guess. We're at number one.
Our number one.
Number one. Best film of the year.
All right. I don't blame you guys for forgetting that Hail Caesar came out in 2016. I mean, after all, its own studio, Universal, I think, forgot that Hail Caesar came out in 2016. There's been no awards push.
We got no screener for it.
Nothing no at push. All. That's no right. word. It's wow. just like this movie didn't exist. I think, you know, this speaks to its February release, but also I think to this misguided notion that the more serious Coen Brothers pictures are the ones that really matter. I'd put Hail Caesar up there with the best of those. When I reviewed it on the show in February, I wondered if it might be the Coens' magnum opus. I mean, this is, after all, a meta exercise considering their career in many ways. It's a comedy set on a studio lot in the 1950s and really considers the worth, both artistic and spiritual, of movie making itself. So it'd been a long time, and I needed an answer to the question I sort of posed myself many months ago. So last night, probably should have, Genevieve, watched 13th, been more prepared. Scott, Aquarius. Sounds great.
Yeah.
I should have watched that. And Adam, I guess I could have stayed up all night watching OJ. 10 hours? Is that what it is?
Close.
But instead, brave the 5-degree temperatures, went to my Redbox, because I don't think it's streaming for rent anywhere, and grabbed Hail Caesar again, put it in and gave it a last-minute revisit. It is, I'll still say, without a doubt, my favorite movie of 2016. If it's still too soon to anoint it as, you know, the Coen's magnum opus, I think it's in the running for me with the likes of Miller's Crossing and No Country for Old Men. Given the production numbers that we get to enjoy here, I think you could call this La La Land with more meaning. Mm-hmm. Given the spiritual torment suffered by its main character, Josh Brolin's Catholic studio fixer, you could consider this to be Silence with more mystery. And I do appreciate both of those films, but Hail Caesar somehow, it combines the delight and depth of them both into one grand and glorious entertainment. So, Hail Caesar, indeed.
Now you listen to me, Buster. Nick Skank in the studio have been good to you and to everyone else who works here. If I ever hear you bad-mouthing Mr. Skank again, it'll be the last thing you say before I have you tossed in jail for colluding in your own abduction.
Eddie, I would never do that.
Shut up. You're going to go out there and you're going to finish Hail Caesar. You're going to give that speech to the feet of the penitent thief and you're going to believe every word you say. You're going to do it because you're an actor and that's what you do. Just like the director does what he does and the writer and the script girl and the guy who claps the slate. You're going to do it because the picture has worth. And you have worth if you serve the picture, and you're never going to forget that again.
I won't forget, Eddie.
Damn right you won't. Not as long as I run this dump.
You're making me feel guilty for bumping it off my list at the last minute.
Genevieve.
I know.
For shame.
There were too many good movies this year. But yeah, as far as like the year's kind of hooray for Hollywood films, I think it's head and shoulders above La La Land for me. And I think the Silence comparison is also interesting because that's a film that left me a little colder than other people at this table.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't like jump all over me for that one.
You know, well, it was fine. It was fine.
Come on, go fine plus.
It was like give it a fine plus.
I'd go more fine minus, actually.
Whoa. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it is because it came out so long ago, and I'm guilty of that. Or maybe it's because I've only seen it once, and every Coen Brothers movie needs that second rewatch to really appreciate it. I've had that experience with every single Coen Brothers film I've seen, except maybe Raising Arizona, which I saw as a 9-year-old and thought was hilarious, and I still think it's hilarious. And Fargo was one I can say I loved the very first time I saw it. But you talk about putting it within the scope of their work. I'm looking at my ranked list over at Letterboxd, and this speaks more to how great the Coen Brothers are and how much I love them as filmmakers.
It's
not really a knock on Hail Caesar. I've got it at 11. So 10 other movies are pretty fantastic I have ahead of that one. So I don't know if it maybe did just take a back seat in my mind. That said, it's in my top 20. So I can't really
is that a
come up with a negative.
On two lists then? You and Genevieve have
no,
it right on that?
No, number 11 in my list of Coen Brothers films.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it. No, I think it's a great pick, and I think it might be recency bias. I saw it twice in the theaters. I think it's got all sorts of resonance. I like, we did a fun show comparing it to Barton Fink, which are both set at Capitol Pictures. And this one has a more cheerful, I suppose, perspective on affection for that particular period in studio filmmaking. And you get that to see that realized in real numbers, you know, and Channing Tatum.
So no dames.
Right, no dames.
And even the intricacy of the Scarlett Johansson swim extravaganza. I mean, it wasn't until the revisit I realized, and maybe they're manipulating digitally, but the swimmers' suits, it appears to be one half. The front is like red, and the back is yellow. And as they swim and turn, I mean, this is something that is as engaging as the originals were. And here's another comparison to La La Land in some ways. That, it was just another pure joy experience for me.
And two Scene of the Year contenders, right?
All right, let's try this. Your line, just say it as I say it. Say your line exactly as I'm about to, just as I'm about to do.
Sure, okay.
Would that it were so simple.
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 My dear boy, why do you say that? Why do you say twer?
Well, you should say it like I said.
Would that it were so simple is what?
I'll never stop laughing.
That one's great. And then I think other more low-key is also with Alden Ehrenreich when he is waiting to have his date.
Such a lovely, quiet moment of him just spinning that lasso on the street. And then she comes out and they just enjoy each other's creativity. Yeah. She shows him how to balance, fruit on your head. And it's just entertainment.
And it's also not very Coen-y. It's got a kind of more relaxed quality to it. It's beautiful.
I'm going to attempt to redeem myself real quick by saying I am in a Critics Award Season Fantasy League, and I went all in on Hail Caesar very foolishly. I'm dead last. But the name of my team is Would That It Were So Simple. So I am here for your Hail Caesar love, even if it's losing
Thank you.
The title.
All right, Scott, wow, us, your number one.
My number one is Manchester by the Sea, the Kenneth Lonergan film. I don't know if I've seen a better film about the subject of grief. I've seen it multiple times. I mean, we got a screener of it, and I've had to watch it over and over again just so I can watch it without breaking down in certain critical scenes and get a real sense of Lonergan's art and how he's building these scenes up and how he's structuring the film. It's cut together in a kind of a jagged way. I mean, Margaret was the same way where it feels alive, almost like a work in progress, and not in a bad way. I don't feel like a film's need to be rounded off, or you really need to buff out the rough edges sometimes. Certainly not when you're making a film about grief and going through really the serious situation that Casey Affleck's character is going through, you really can be a little bit messy. But I appreciate Lonergan's keen ear for regional dialogue, as Genevieve discussed, great sense of humor. And I also appreciate how it comes to a tough conclusion about grief as a mountain that might be too steep to climb. Mm-hmm. After I just saw it was in what really brought it into sharp relief for me was seeing the worst film of the year this month was this film Collateral Beauty, which is kind of a Hollywood film about grief. And in that film, grief becomes this absurd pseudo-religious apparatus that I think typifies Hollywood's inability to deal with serious issues directly. And Lonergan doesn't have that problem. There's a frankness to Manchester by the Sea that I appreciate, and that I think the film is going to be tough for a lot of people to sit through, as much as he makes it easy on them with the humor. But I loved it, and it's the one that's really going to stick with me from 2016.
Yeah, you talk about the biases that go into making these lists, and I almost didn't put Manchester on my list because I didn't want to have to talk about it at length. it's that wrecking, and I did manage to write about it briefly on my site, and I called it a portrait of a man who deals with grief by submerging it into the marrow of his bones. Mm-hmm. And that was just too familiar for me to really deal with. But there's an authenticity there in Affleck's performance, but yeah, in how Lonergan just frames each scene, and just in a more film critic approach to it. I think it's very key in Lonergan's development visually as well, mm-hmm. because every scene here is composed so carefully and not showily, not to make these landscapes, these wintry landscapes, which echo the emotional scenery as well, mm-hmm. not to make them beautiful but just these are frames you want to look at and you want to sit with and you want to consider where the characters are in them and what that might mean for them. So it works on a lot of levels.
And the camera is pretty still, but I think movement of the actors within the space is also crucial to this film. A lot of people were hoping this is a movie that would have been discussed on Film Spotting. Certainly, yeah. We felt that way too. Sometimes those movies get lost in that Thanksgiving week shuffle. That
I'm kind of glad this
here.
One did.
I know. I'm going to contradict everything you said. I'm going to throw out there that I really regret that we didn't get a chance to see it because it would have forced me to articulate what I love about the movie so much. And I do love it. And maybe, Josh, you can buck up a little bit, and in February or something, when it's pretty bleak and there's nothing else to talk about, maybe we go back to a Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, we'll see if I'm up to it.
Okay. You're number one, Genevieve.
Oh, wow, we're at number one. My number one's The Handmaiden. It's the moviest movie I saw this year. It's just compelling from the first moment to the last and just visually stunning throughout. I don't know that there is much left to say about how great this movie is. I think the direction is what really makes this movie work, particularly Park Chan-wook's use of framing and match cuts, which help establish this emotional continuum that the film works on, even as its plot is twisting and turning every which way. So even though there's this really kind of like sense that you gotta just hold on as this plot, like, you know, veers all over the place, you feel like you're with this movie. You know, it's never, you're never going to get bucked off. And it's my favorite film going experience of the year, and one I've enjoyed forcing on other people and listening to them tell me how right I am.
Is that another one totally unlike Sing Street, but when you recommend it to people, have people sought it out and been rewarded?
Oh, yes. And I have created other apostles.
I think so.
Yeah.
Disciples.
Yes, and I've created more disciples who have gone on to spread the word further.
Love it. Certainly, I hope more people can see that film. I meant to mention it when it came up earlier on my list that it is one of those films that, as of our taping anyway, is not available on DVD or for rental anywhere, but it is still playing in some select cities around the country, and that's the best way to see it if you have that opportunity. My number one film of the year is the movie about the day in 1966, August 1st, when a man rode the elevator up to the top of the University of Texas Tower and started shooting, basically held the campus hostage for 96 minutes. It's called Tower. No other movie from this year provoked a more visceral reaction. The technique of it is wondrous, combining rotoscoped animated interviews and recreations with archival footage and photos and sound, and later some non-animated interviews. In terms of the suspense of it, it unfolds almost in real time. It's a 96-minute movie, and it's not about looking back and trying to put this event within some larger historical context. It's about experiencing it as it happens, along with these students and the other community members and the victims. And then there's the emotional catharsis that this film culminates with, and I'll get to just a little bit more on that in a second. Fitting in with my larger theme for this year, of course, this is a shooting that rocked that Texas campus and the Austin community, but it was also the first mass school shooting in America. And the director, Keith Maitland, I love how he consistently cuts to that tower, even when there are no bullets coming from that tower, or he frames the tower so it's visible within the shots on the ground. And this makes sense. It's where the bullets are coming from. It's a key part of the narrative that's unfolding. But I kept thinking every time it was shown about what it must have been like for people who experienced it in the immediate aftermath of the event, and now maybe even 50 years later, when they see that tower. They'll never be able to experience that place, that site, their community, the exact same way again. Something that surely was a comforting image that made them think of home has been forever transformed into a source of terror.
I was in Shakespeare class when it started, and we all ran to the windows of the English building.
The miracle of Tower, I think, is that it could have been made and have still been a very effective movie had it been made by some other director, an outsider. They could have taken a similar approach with the animation and the archival footage. But there's something about the DNA of this film that I think has to come from Maitland being someone from the area who went to the University of Texas, who grew up hearing these stories. I read on their website that he heard it first from his seventh grade history teacher who witnessed it. And the other thing I love is that he doesn't try to explain the actions of the gunman. We don't learn until later, even. I remember the name because I do know of the event, but Charles Whitman, that doesn't come up until the last few minutes of this film, because it's not about him. And it's not about trying to explain him or his psychology. And we don't even see him until the people within the story actually encounter him. But he's just very clearly so interested in the victims and the survivor story and not the story of this man. The catharsis I mentioned and the moment from this film, I can't get into it too much because I don't want to spoil it. I want people to experience this film if they have the opportunity. Right now, it's another one that is playing around the country on a few screens, and we'll link to it in our show notes, but otherwise isn't available. There are questions I think any viewer is asking themselves as they're watching this film. Why make this movie? Why should audiences experience it? Why should survivors relive it? And Maitland answers those questions by the end of this movie, and it was the most powerful thing I saw on screen all year. I do want to mention one other thing about this movie that really fascinated me. And Michael Phillips, our friend usually here as part of our interview roundtable, in his top 10 list for the Chicago Tribune, in his preamble, he said this: people know these events happen, not talking about Tower, talking about other events. He says, these words and actions took place. Caring about them is another story. America now exists in a state of disbelief, roughly one half of the country in a belligerent good mood, the other half in a cold sweat. Facts, visual or otherwise, have lost a lot of their market value. The country hasn't been so plainly fractured since 1968. There's a moment in Tower where we're hearing the story from one of the heroes, really, of the story, someone who goes out to rescue a woman on the ground. And we, up to this point, have only seen him in animated form. We've seen him in animated form as far as a recreation goes. And he starts talking about how we had to move fast. We knew that. And all of a sudden, it switches to real life. It's the actual footage. There was a camera there that captured his act as he ran out with other people to save this person. And actually seeing it happen, it's indisputable. It goes down just the way he said it went down. And that act, of course, watching that act of heroism took my breath away because it's tremendously courageous. But even more breathtaking somehow was just the authenticity of it. Seeing in that moment it actually unfold. I just think we are, to Michael's point, we're so untethered from reality day to day anymore that just seeing this grainy Super 8 or 16 millimeter footage, something that was verifiable, something unquestionable, it shook me. And I think the movie as a whole will probably have that effect on a lot of people who do eventually get to see it. It's a Golden Brick candidate and not faring so well in the poll, mainly because I think not enough people have seen it.
I just remember looking up at the sky. It was so blue. And just thinking, I guess this is it.
That's when I decided to go out there. And we had to move fast. We knew that. You can see, there was a camera. Time moves strangely, slowly. I grabbed Claire's feet. James grabbed Claire's arms.
I think the animation is so crucial here. It's not, you know, it's certainly not a gimmick, and it's not even just an aesthetic pleasure. It doesn't just add something visually. It compresses the time for us. This is intensely suspenseful, this movie to watch. Part of the reason is because of the pops of gunfire in the soundtrack that are repeated throughout to make you feel as the witnesses would feel. But that animation, by having the talking heads as they may have looked in 1966,
right,
we're still in that time. We're not jumping back from the present and their memories to the past. So it does, it's an aesthetic detail that adds a whole nother level of intensity to the documentary.
I think it's one of the real elements of surprise to the film. And I don't just mean in terms of a reveal, but as you're watching, you're looking at young people talk about an event, and they clearly do look as they did during these events. And you're wondering, okay, are we watching actors here who are reading or enacting a transcript, or what exactly is going on? All these answers are eventually revealed. And I think that's part of what makes this film so thrilling to watch.
Talking about miracles, the fact that this technique of reenactments, like the fact that it wasn't distasteful or tacky, is pretty amazing. And the rotoscoping definitely contributes to that. I can't place my finger exactly on why it works so well. I just know that it does.
Yeah, you couldn't do a straight recreation of this without it being distasteful or mm-hmm. I think that choice is a crucial one. There are a lot of just really smart choices throughout that everyone has mentioned. I mean, the and foremost for me is just keeping Charles Whitman out of it, mm-hmm. And not delving into that psychology, because you know if we're talking about this incident as being the first of what we now experience as a plague of mass shootings, I mean, who do we know the most about? We always know the most about the gunman
and totally.
What motivated this guy to do what he did. And I think a lot of people are pretty tired of that because, you know, it's giving them what they want. It's giving them the attention mm-hmm. that they want. There are these figures of these disturbing, dark figures of mystery. What Tower does instead is just emphasizes everyday heroism. Yeah. And in one case, a certain powerlessness that mm-hmm. they could not be helpful in mm-hmm. in that situation, that they weren't able to risk their lives to help. So, you know, and you just you're moved by the decency of people and of complete strangers mm. willing to risk their lives for each other.
The breadth of experiences it's covered, I think, is really crucial too, because it's not just the heroes, it's not just the victims. Like, there's it really forms a not complete, but a well-rounded picture of what happened on that day.
Yeah, it's a work of journalism mm-hmm. in many ways, even though it takes a lot of creative liberties.
Well, I'm glad we could at least all agree that my number one pick is pretty decent if we couldn't agree on Sing Street. Those are our top 10 films of the year. We have had a lot of films come up as honorable mentions and have managed to work several titles into the mix. I will go ahead and throw out to the group any titles we haven't mentioned at this point that you want to make sure people are aware of and seek out.
So I'm looking at my 11 through whatever list, and many of these have already come up. I think I do have Patterson at 11. That was such a pleasure. The Witch was in the running at the halfway year point for some of the best of the year, and it's still up there for me. Love and Friendship, I don't think has come up at all, mm-mm. but I was able to catch just a few weeks ago, enjoyed that quite a bit. And I think the only other one I might throw out there is a really strong animated effort, April and the Extraordinary World. I enjoyed quite a bit.
There's tons of honorable mentions for me. This is a real quantity year. We already mentioned Arrival. Everybody wants some OJ, Tower, Certain Women, Hail Caesar, The Witch. I like The Nice Guys quite a bit. Camera Person, Krisha, Love and Friendship, which I'm glad you brought up. Little Men by Ira Sachs, Appear in the Farm, which I had mentioned before. Fire at Sea, which I hadn't mentioned, an Italian documentary that's highly cinematic and deals with the immigration issue and the issue of African refugees with a great deal of artistry and candor. Don't Breathe, the studio horror film, I think is just exceptionally directed and is a scare machine. I thought it was about as good as it gets. The BFG, Kubo and the Two Strings, Pete's Dragon, these are all films that redeemed the summer for me. I thought it was a strong, you know, when the Pixar film is the fourth best family film of the summer, then you've had a pretty good summer for children's films. And of course, The Neon Demon, I would mention as well as being a film I admired.
Yep. Several have already been mentioned. Hail Caesar, Camera Person, Sing Street, Patterson, Love and Friendship, which I'm glad you brought up. One of my favorite comedies of the year for sure. I'll also throw The Witch on my runners up, which as a non-horror aficionado might be a little surprising, but I enjoyed it a great deal. Some titles we haven't brought up yet that are on my list: Hunt for the Wilder People, Taika Waititi's film, and Hell or High Water.
So looking at my top 30 here, almost every single film on this list has already been mentioned by me or by you guys. Several of them made your lists. Also, some of our callers touch on these films. The only titles that stand out that haven't been named at all yet: Terrence Davies' Sunset Song in my top 25, and Hunt for the Wilder People was one I thought I was going to be the first to mention. Midnight Special has been mentioned, came up in the context of Jeff Nichols and Loving. That's in my top 30 as well. Over at filmspotting.net, we will post the top 5 page where we will include all of the titles that have come up here on our top 10 list, maybe some of the honorable mentions as well. We will also list the titles of our guest picks. We have one more guest pick to get in, actually. Both these titles now have been mentioned, but love hearing from Stephen Hayden, who wrote a great book this year about the all-time best music rivalries. He helped us count down the top 5 movie rivalries, and he is leaning towards OJ, Made in America, with this pick, but he's with you, Genevieve, that he's not completely convinced that it's not a TV show. So he's got another option that he wants to throw into the mix that he definitely knows is a movie and definitely knows he loves.
If I had to pick something else that's more sort of unequivocally a movie, I'm going to go with Shane Black's The Nice Guys. It's certainly the movie that I saw the most this year. I bought it on Blu-ray, and I had a baby a month and a half ago, so I've been up late at night. And when I'm tired and I feel like dozing off, I just put on The Nice Guys for about 20 minutes, and it keeps me up. I just love the fact that every 10 years we can expect a great buddy cop movie from Shane Black. You know, you had Lethal Weapon in the 80s, you had The Last Boy Scout in the 90s, you had Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in the aughts, and now you have The Nice Guys. So, great movie. Thanks again. Bye.
Thank you, Stephen Hayden. Thank you to everyone who called in. And thank you to Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky, who stuck with us through the long haul here.
Thanks so
two
much,
episodes,
guys.
Both parts. We made it through 10 films and about 50 other titles. Thank you, guys.
Oh, it was such a trauma. So hard.
But a miracle. But a miracle as well.
I wanted you to experience it the way I experienced the year, and I apparently succeeded. Do you guys want to promote anything, including, I'm guessing, the next picture show?
Please check out the next picture show, in which we compare a new film with a classic film of a similar theme. And for our most recent episode, our last episode of 2016, we compare La La Land with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
You can find that at nextpictureshow.net and also simply by doing a search in iTunes. We look forward to your feedback on this episode. You can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting. Josh is at Larson on Film.
Over at filmspotting.net, you'll find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are in the show archives. When you're over there, go ahead and vote in the current Film Spotting poll. This is a big one. It's the Golden Brick poll, and your vote will help determine the final winner. As for next week, we don't know what we're doing.
We don't.
We can hardly think straight.
Other than
point.
We're preparing for our year-end wrap party live at the Logan Center for the Arts.
We do have that. In between, we might give you a fix, a quick review of one of the year-end releases we haven't been able to give a lot of time to.
4 minutes on Manchester by the Sea.
That's about. I could probably do that. At this point, I could probably do that.
Okay.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed what you heard on this show, go over to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review. We're always looking for new listeners. That's a great way to find them. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.